Hey everybody, welcome to another teaser episode of B-Movie Mania. Paul Brooks with you here, and we're going to do something just a little bit different today. We're going to be talking about The Evil Within, and I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the strange sort of backstory and things like that surrounding the film, tell you a little bit about the movie and, you know, just whet your appetite for it. So I brought in my dear friend and a friend of the pod, Tim Bavlenka, is joining me. Tim, are you there?
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. If you listened to the show before, you'll know Tim from Turbulence 3 Heavy Metal, our season 4 premiere.
Yeah.
And you've been on the show before doing ghost hunting and, you know, all sorts of different stuff.
Yeah, and I'm involved with the B-Movie Mania television show that you can watch exclusively on YouTube at this point.
That is correct. One of our men on the street and the only one who is still alive.
Yeah. And hey, watch that Erotic Thrillers episode. I'm all up in there as well.
Absolutely. Tim, thank you for joining me on this teaser episode. So The Evil Within came out just a couple years ago, 2017, and it is basically, I'm reading this off of IMDb, the plot is the sadistic tale of a lonely, mentally handicapped boy who befriends his reflection in an antique mirror. This demonic creature orders him to go on a murderous rampage to kill the people he loves most. So even just based on the plot description there, you can tell it's a little bit of a strange psychological horror movie. Tim, how did you first find out about this movie?
Well, at the time I was in grad school for film studies. I dropped out, but I was studying horror film. And what came up for me was there was an article on The Guardian about, I popped up the article, so I'll just read the headline. A Millionaire, His Meth Addiction, and the Horror Movie 15 Years in the Making.
Wow.
The Evil Within, a strange, gory film poured over meticulously in his mansion by the oil dynasty scion Andrew Getty until his death, is finally getting released. That article obviously caught my attention. I think it caught a lot of people's attention who are kind of in the greater horror movie scene. And I read that article before I saw the movie because there wasn't really a way to see it at this point. This article came out in March 2017. And it was really just this bizarre story about the making of this movie. And I was fascinated by this. I was super excited about it. I bought it without any question and watched it, and I absolutely loved it. I think I was texting you pretty much immediately during all of it, saying, like, you have to watch this movie by whatever means necessary.
Yeah, wow. And I think one of the things that really struck me about this is, you know, the fact that Andrew Getty, who is this, like, oil heir to the Getty oil fortune, but is not really a filmmaker. And I tend to, you know, if there's somebody out there who's trying to make a movie who kind of doesn't know what they're doing, I gravitate towards that for some reason.
Yeah.
You know, your Tommy Wiseau's or even farther back to Manos, The Hands of Fate, Harold Warren. So it's an interesting situation because here's somebody who's got a lot of money who doesn't necessarily have a background in film, but
yeah,
starting in like, what, 2002, he just started working on this thing.
Yeah, I looked up the family real quick. So he's the grandson of the original Getty oil guy. And so his father wasn't really involved in the business. He came from like the artistic guy. So his father was like a classical musician and stuff like that, but he had $2 billion. So this guy grew up pretty well entrenched in the arts, but also significantly wealthy.
Yep.
And seemingly, or as far as I can tell, no formal training. You know, he didn't go to film school or anything like that. And so this guy presumably kind of grew up in a home that supported the arts and probably was surrounded by film and music his whole life. I would kind of guess that would be the case.
I would guess that would be the case as well. Although I heard some stuff about his grandfather that would definitely suggest that not everyone was thrilled about, you know, the more artistic side of things. From all indications, what's his name? J.P. Getty?
Yeah.
That guy was an asshole.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't dig around too much into the family history, but I've read a little bit about the company and sort of their eventual sale and collapse, and it sounds like they were screwing people over left and right until basically the nail in the coffin of the company.
Not cool. Definitely not cool. But let's talk a little bit more about the movie itself.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, for the audience here, it's a possibility that we might be getting into some spoilers.
Right.
What are some of the things that, you know, when you first sat down to watch this movie, one of the biggest things right off the bat is the visuals are just incredible. What are some of the things that struck you about the look and the style of this film?
We you know, Paul and I, for the sake of transparency, we rewatched this movie the night before.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's worth repeating that this movie took 15 years to make.
Yep.
And so there are times, there are significant kind of shifts in aesthetics and things like that. And I think most notably that's in the opening scene that's sort of setting up this internalized, you know, scarred, traumatic landscape of the main character. And the opening scene is this very intense, very elaborate mix of practical effects, stop motion animation, very classical, like Hollywood early cinema special effects, like overlays and double exposures and things like that, where it's layers and layers and layers of stuff, but it's all practical. Like, as far as I can tell, there's not really any CGI, at least not noticeably so. Like, there might be digital layering and stuff like that, but so there's this shot that's just kind of within the main character's mind. So you're seeing sort of this dream landscape and sort of this history of the character kind of unfold on screen, but it's so intense. And Paul, when you mentioned spoilers, I couldn't help but think there's really no way to spoil this, because I don't know if I can describe things as intensely as it comes up on screen, because the stuff you end up seeing in this movie, like you can say like, hey, it's whatever, but it ends up being much more intense than you or anyone would really expect out of a movie like this.
Yeah, it's definitely tough to do it justice in terms of just trying to describe it, especially that opening shot or that opening scene is one of the most intense things in the entire movie, really.
And it comes off as very clearly filmed separate from the rest of the movie, probably years after the fact.
Well, from what I understand, based on what I read, they started shooting in 2002. It took them 6 years. They had a lot of issues going on, and so they were shooting sort of sporadically all the way up until 2008. And then from 2008 up to the time of Andrew Getty's death in 2015, it was just him sort of like sitting in the mansion, like tinkering with it, like frame by frame, you know, meticulously going over all of the effects and everything. So it's got a long, strange history.
Yeah, yeah. I would also just recommend any reader or listeners that are particularly interested, go Google The Evil Within and Guardian, and this article should pop right up. It's got a pretty solid synopsis of the backstory of the movie as well. So,
yeah, I needed to read that article. Could you send that to me?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Because we're actually recording the proper episode later tonight. So that'd be nice to have some more background info for the guys.
Yeah, there's this bit I'll read right here. He converted one of his mansion's many rooms into a post-production suite where he spent untold years on intricate in-camera special effects techniques.
Yeah, like he handcrafted like animatronic puppets that are in this movie. I guess just by himself. Maybe he had some sort of background in that, or maybe he just learned how to do it for this movie. I don't know.
And that just comes up as this kind of interesting circular relationship between the director and the film itself, because that's essentially what the character is doing this whole movie, right? He's learning and creating this insane scenario that is ultimately shown to the audience by the end of the film in the last couple of minutes. But that's kind of the story of the director himself, right? He, an amateur with no background in filmmaking, going through elaborate efforts to make this movie and show it to people. That's kind of what we get by the end of the movie.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely very autobiographical. I mean, even if you look at photos of Andrew Getty in his earlier years, he bears a resemblance to the main character of the film, Dennis, who's played by Frederick Kohler, I believe his name is.
Yeah, and he's a fairly recognizable sort of genre actor.
Yeah, which surprised me a little bit, to be honest, because I don't recall him being... I looked up his IMDb, and he's definitely done plenty of stuff, but I don't personally know him from anything else.
I recognized him from the Death Race remake franchise.
Oh, right.
Jason Statham, but then the subsequent sequels of those as well, which they're fun little dumb movies, but he's the main character in like four of those movies.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about sort of the meaning behind some of the stuff that's going on in this movie, because it is very autobiographical, and a lot of it, I mean, the whole thing revolves around Andrew Getty's actual nightmares that he supposedly had when he was younger. So talk a little bit about, you know, what you think that he was trying to get across on screen by taking his real nightmares and putting them in this movie.
I think there's got to be a lot of issues with Andrew. I mean, this is a man, I don't know if we mentioned it, but he died of basically a complication of meth addiction.
Right.
So this is a guy who dealt with drug abuse and addiction, possibly some mental illness to some degree. I mean, not to stigmatize it, because a lot of us deal with mental illness to some degree. But also, I the family life, I suspect, had to be a very difficult experience growing up. You know, being the child of a billionaire, there's got to be some difficulty in how do I go out in and make a name for myself, you know, establish or create something of my own, right? I have two, if you have a family that's worth billions of dollars, like, what do you do with your time? How do you express yourself, right? Like, you could just sit around and not do anything for your entire life. But this is very clearly a guy who had the need and drive to express himself in a way that was separate from his family's legacy. And I think that burden was probably weighing very heavy on his whole life, right? So we have this guy who had just terrible nightmares, which are translated in the film. And I think that visually, these are some of the most intense parts of the movie as a whole. But also, it's got to have some kind of identity crisis for him as somebody struggling with these aspects of his life, right? Like the family dynasty versus his need to express himself. I'm obviously kind of projecting a little bit here, but I would suspect that's probably some sort of mental drive for this guy, right? Like the need to express himself. But we're seeing these super dark, very disturbing nightmares the whole movie, which add, I mean, just like on their own. I know, Paul, you mentioned the other night that you gasped during a certain part of the film.
Yep.
So there are scenes that are incredibly intense and incredibly disturbing, like in a way that you do not see in mainstream horror or even really all that much in independent horror. So there's this clash. It's hard to summarize because there's this, A, we're seeing this horror movie, but B, it's the greater narrative. It's the meta-text, which I find a lot more important. This story of the director and how that translates into this film.
Right.
And I think that's, for me, perhaps the most interesting part, because the movie on its own,
it's not without its flaws.
It's not without its flaws, certainly. There are these scenes that are just way more intense than you would typically see in a B-level horror film.
Well, I think, you know, I think a lot of that probably has to do with sort of a catharsis for him, you know?
Oh, yeah. I imagine
A way for this guy who's had these nightmares for so long to externalize them and put them into the world to sort of like take the weight off his shoulders a little bit.
And have the disposable income to be able to do so.
Right.
Right? So like, I mean, obviously he's coming from, let's just assume, the more artistic side of this family, but having the millions of dollars to be able to create this sort of artistic text. I mean, I've had very vivid, terrifying nightmares in my past, but to create that visually in a film would, I mean, that's a Herculean effort to some degree.
Yeah, he's in a unique position kind of to be able to take something very fantastical in his own head and put a lot of money into it, reportedly somewhere between $4 to $6 million. That is not the type of thing that if you're an independent filmmaker, you know, working with not a lot of money, you're not going to be able to do something like that.
And then there's just the actual animatronics.
Yeah.
I mean, animatronics are expensive. I mean, you build them once and then they last, they're supposed to last forever. Like, you know, the Chuck E. Cheese stuff or whatever.
Yeah, there's some very Chuck E. Cheese-esque stuff in this movie.
But they just built them. Just original animatronic effects for like a 30-second shot of the film. But it was important. It was an important 30 seconds. It's an important animatronic.
Yeah.
I mean, even that carnival scene, there's the haunted house ride that they ride on. That ties in to the very end of the movie. I mean, all this stuff that is sort of like the expensive detritus that kind of these curious elements through all the movie, they all tie in. They all pay off at the end of the movie.
They do. That's a good point. And I think it's interesting because in one sense, you know, there is some structure to it. You know, there's a lot of setup that, you know, where we see some payoff later on. On the other hand, he sort of wasn't, the movie isn't necessarily bound by a traditional sort of formulaic structure to it. So,
yeah,
because this is the only movie he ever made. I mean, obviously he died before he finished it, but he's not restrained by traditional thinking. And to me, that just ends up making it more interesting.
Yeah. He died, I believe, in 2015, and the movie came out in early 2017. So I think he had maybe an editing partner help just basically
he did. One
get
of the
some
other,
stuff together.
Yeah, one of the other producers on the film was involved with sort of some assistant editing while Andrew Getty was still alive. And then after he died, the producer took over and finished the edit.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's another interesting point. We might not exactly know how much of Andrew's vision for this movie is in the final product, because it's a little difficult to say whether or not the editing choices that ultimately were made by the producer were the choices that he would have made had he lived long enough to finish the movie.
Or if there's other footage sitting around. I mean, this is a pretty classic, like, 90-minute horror movie, but working on it for so long, there's got to be other content sitting around.
Oh, absolutely. There. Because if I understand correctly, there was actors in the movie who dropped out at some point or didn't work out or whatever. So there's probably a lot.
Yeah.
Over. I mean, if you're shooting something for 6 years, there's going to be a lot on the cutting room floor. And I know I heard that he, while he was alive and working on the film, he would do things like color correct all of the unedited footage. Just before he started assembling the movie, he color corrected everything. Just weird stuff like that, where the way that he was going about this entire process was just different from the normal way you'd put together a movie.
Yeah, and just doing it himself.
Right.
But yeah, I just want to say, like, overall, so, you know, I study horror movies for a long time, and my main approach to horror kind of has to do with this idea of tension and difference. So, obviously the villain is always this sort of unknowable force, right? So you have your own kind of perceivable reality, and then there's a monster, right? Like, monsters aren't supposed to exist,
mm-hmm.
but there they are. And then there's tension between those things.
Right.
In this context, like, you can read that just within the movie itself, but also I think that translates even greater to the metatext of the movie, like the idea of the creator, the actual director, Andrew Getty, and this kind of impossible struggle to make this movie. Like, somebody who shouldn't have been making a movie or had no, you know, previous history in movie making, obviously this huge drive and surge to translate some sort of trauma in his life into film. Like, there's that level to it too, which for me is what makes this film even more important, even more scary than just a typical horror movie. Like, it's all the relationship outside of the actual film production that ties back into this. And this is a must watch, but also, like, you have to kind of explain the scenario of this movie a little bit too.
Yeah. And it's interesting because another sort of parallel here, Andrew did not make it to see his vision fully realized. And in the film, you know, his sort of character that he's supposed to be, Dennis, kind of gets the show that he wanted at the end, but at what cost, you know?
Right, right.
Let's just say it costs him a lot.
Yeah. Without spoiling the end of the movie, it's one of the more bonkers, insane ends to any horror movie that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
I mean, it's truly impressive.
It is. And it's, I think one of the things that's impressive about it is that they set things up throughout the film so that it's not something that comes out of nowhere. But at the same time, I definitely, you know, it's not something that I saw coming.
No. And it also just some great effects in the end. I mean, just the puppetry and the performance style effects going on with it are just, they're pretty mind-boggling.
Absolutely. There is some questionable, what would you say? I mean, there's some people who might be offended with some of the content in the film. I mean, it's a horror movie, so there are some pretty unpleasant things happening in terms of the storyline. Nothing gratuitous. I wouldn't say that you say anything that is going to be, well, it just really depends on whether or not you're into this sort of thing, but stuff gets pretty wild at some point.
Yeah, I mean, even just the main character, Paul, you and I were talking about, he's an autistic guy with pretty severe autism in the film, but even the actor trying to portray that, it kind of borderlines as inappropriate, but also he's not playing a caricature. It's just, it's a performance, right? So like,
right.
And then yeah, there is some fairly violent content in the movie as well that probably could have been left out, but sort of works for this particular film.
Yeah, I'm going to be interested actually to see what the other guys think. I don't think anyone else is going to like this.
and that's something I've read, and I think it's even mentioned in that Guardian article or some other articles that came out during the time of its release in early 2017, was this idea that you're either going to think this is a work of true genius or you're going to just hate it.
Right.
It's a very, very divisive, very 50-50 kind of movie. And for me, it's a work of genius. I truly love it.
Wow. There you go. Yeah, it is definitely, if nothing else, it is a pretty unique experience. And, you know, the level of the attention to detail and the amount of work that went into it. I mean, like we said, it took 15 years to make this thing. So,
yeah. And how often do you get to see a truly unique horror movie?
Exactly.
Not very often. I mean, the right. experience of it alone is something.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you are interested in watching the film, it is available for free on Amazon Prime for Prime members. I don't know if it's on Tubi or anything else, but it's out there if you want to find it. Tim, thank you so much for hopping on here and chatting with me about the movie a little bit.
Hey, Paul, thanks for having me. I always love coming on and talking to you guys.
Thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you next week for the review of The Evil Within on B-Movie Mania.